Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Zila Eisenstein. Eisenstein is a professor of politics at Ithaca College. She is an anti-racist feminist and author of many groundbreaking books on politics and political and feminist theory. Her many books include Man-Made Breast Cancers, Against Empire, Feminisms, Racism, and the West, Sexual Decoys, Gender, Race, and War in Imperial Democracy, and her soon-to-be-released book, The Audacity of Races and Genders, A Personal and Global Story of the Obama Election, forthcoming from Zed Books. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Now, so much of your writing underlines the idea of the personal as political, so let's begin there. The beginning of your new book, you talk about how you were coming out of chemotherapy after a second bout with cancer. Tell us about what you call your mindscape.
I guess, my mindscape is always the blend of the personal experiences of my life, that of course begin with all of us in the early stages of development, the daughter of communist parents, struggling really very hard in the civil rights movement at that time, growing up with all of the richness and the difficulties of having your personal life defined by political movements and initiatives that are bigger than yourself. Mm. But then particularly my involvement in the women's movement in the United States in the late 70s and through the 80s and beyond in its different permutations. Mm-hmm. The most key rich idea, I think, that feminism has offered politics is the idea that the personal is political, the political is personal, and mm-hmm. they aren't the same thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in my own life, some of the struggles with breast cancer and then a really undefined second cancer just always kept me located with the fact that those personal dimensions of my life also had political implications.
Mm-hmm. Now you said that all your thinking and writing about race and gender for these many, many years that you've written and then thought about these issues was up in front and center suddenly during the 2008 presidential campaign. Tell us about that, how that culminated and reached you in such a way.
Well, it was just totally amazing, actually. Never having been involved or even all that attentive to traditional politics. And I was actually finishing up chemotherapy, not really very strong at all. But because of the work that I've always done within the women's movement, particularly what then was called the white women's movement, but yet the incredibly important dimension of black feminism in this country, my work always has tried to have a consciousness and a politics that always recognizes that there's a racial base to gender and a gendered base to race. So I've done that intellectually in my work, and I do that politically in both my work and the activism that I'm a part of, both here and across the globe. Mm-hmm. So when it happened at a particular moment, and it was when Hillary really started to realize her campaign was in trouble, and very subtly and silently really started to run in terms of being white. Much more so than being a woman. Although, as we well know, by the time her campaign ended, she had become a woman politically, but that was really not mm-hmm. the beginning. So anyhow, when this happened, many of the black feminists who were involved in Obama's campaign asked, as a white feminist, if I would tackle the issues that Hillary's campaign was creating at that time.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people were disappointed, by the way. Hillary got so desperate, it seemed, that she sort of threw her black supporters out to dry.
Well, again, I've actually tracked Hillary Clinton politically for over two decades mm-hmm. and have written on her at great length long before she ran for president.
Yes, you have.
And actually do think that much of her politics has always been less feminist and more conservative, more, you know, what would be called neoliberal, than is really understood.
Mm-hmm.
What I do think happened in this campaign is that women who really were mobilized as feminists pushed her, and also in the end were really her major supporters. She became, in the end, for the first time ever, I think, politically, identified herself as a woman and as part of feminism.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But she did that as a white woman.
Yes, yes, that's an important point. You have a chapter in the book called Hillary Clinton Chose Not to Be a Feminist. Did you really think she chose not to be a feminist? In what way?
Well, I think that feminism to this day, you know, no matter what form, there are multiple forms of feminism, but whatever form is subversive to the degree of a certain kind of misogyny, etc. And actually, when she was first lady, there were key moments where she could have spoken on behalf of women and never chose to do that.
Yeah.
She has no record, you know, in that sense as a feminist, because she did some early work on children's rights, people sometimes identified her as a feminist. But if you read carefully what that work is, that was really more about preserving the family, and particularly poor families, than it was about feminism.
Yeah, you call her a troubling symbol in your book. You say she abides by masculinist gender rules, and yet she is a symbol of feminism.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't mean to here in any way at this point focus on her as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is so problematic is that women, and particularly feminist women of whatever variety, have so little control over these discourses. So Hillary was chosen really by media and a certain powerful interests in this country to be a symbol for women, and therefore the assumption was for feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And what I try to argue in all of my books, actually, is that there is a huge difference between the identity of woman and the politics of feminisms.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, you make that very clear all through the book. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Now, do you think women have, because of the Hillary's campaign, moved beyond having to look tough by taking this militaristic view? Because it obviously didn't work.
Yeah, well, no, it didn't work, but for, you know, just totally multiple reasons, I think. I think that still that there are, you know, very rigid disciplining ideas for women, for the majority of women all over the globe, about how it is that you proceed and can improve your life. And just very quickly, the new report, A Woman's Nation by Maria Shriver, is, I think, very reflective of that. You know, to the degree that it's saying it's a woman's nation because a majority of women now, there are more women in the labor force than men, but that hardly means that it has become a woman's nation. It just means there are more women in the labor force. And, you know, actually, married black women have been in the labor force in huge numbers historically. So this idea that it's a woman's nation, again, the whiteness of the kind of constructions here are really problematic.
It's prevalent still. And also the fact that women are still not paid as much. And when you're talking about the workforce, you're often talking about low-wage jobs.
Yeah,
still.
Well, it's still at best 72, 77 cents to the dollar, you know, not to mention the fact that, you know, the new global proletariat are girls 13 to 17.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, which I do talk about at great length in the book.
Yeah, you do. Now, you said that the election and the campaign was a kind of a mind bender in that Obama was able to come off as a non-threatening male and Hillary became a militarized, unlikable female. Very interesting. Do you think Obama absolutely needed to do that? Was that a conscious thing for him to come off as a non-threatening male?
Well, I think on some level, because he's a black man,
mm-hmm.
and you know, historically, part of the construction of racism has been black men and sexual prowess and threatening,
mm-hmm.
and you know, it explains why Rodney King had to be beaten beyond a pulp, you know, when he's laying there, but he was still threatening, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, yeah.
So to that degree, you know, who knows what is the consciousness? I mean, Barack Obama has lived in this country, you know, his whole life except for his stint in Indonesia, and you know, you learn how to negotiate the world around you. So I'm not sure. I don't really think that the person he was in the campaign was all that different than the person he was becoming in then having the option of doing the campaign.
I think people were not used to seeing a thoughtful candidate. I think that's what probably threw many people.
Yeah, I think it was a combination. I mean, his personal story and his ability. He has great abilities. You know, what that really means for whether we're going to be a different kind of empire or not, we don't know the answer to that yet.
Yeah, we don't. We don't.
It's looking, you know, more and more problematic and precarious, but it's the whole purpose of both my involvement in the campaign and then writing about it is that politics, you can't write politics before it happens. If you do, then it seems to me that your mind is stuck. And what I really do believe is that it's important to know your politics, but to really also be always reevaluating what the new possibilities might be, given the fact that history and the present always are giving us some new choices. Mm. And if we're not looking for what they might be, we're not going to see them. And, you know, many of the people I have worked with politically before did feel as though there was no real difference here. There could not be. Empire is empire. Mm. And somehow that just did not feel creative enough as a political stance for what was a possibility in the Obama campaign and his election. And as I say in the book, I also do feel like we had no choice but to remove the Bush-Cheney regime. And I am glad that at least in the startup process that we can still be hoping that it will be more than it will be less of really making a difference, even if it's not enough of a difference.
Uh-huh. Do you feel like you got caught up in the yes, we can, and sort of threw away some of your intellectual prowess because of it?
No. I feel what I loved about doing this is that I feel like my intellect was really rattled, and then I grew. I grew intellectually and politically. So I am incredibly skeptical, but I am still engaged. And just last night, Obama watched the coffins of 18 of our military people come home. And this morning he said, that experience will be present for me as I make my decision whether we increase troops. And I'm hoping deeply that this means that he will not increase troops.
Yeah,
so,
Well, I feel like he's brought poetry back into the political landscape, which was sorely missing during the Bush era.
Oh, yeah. The worrisome thing is that poetry can ease us, but it's not enough in a world that is as cruel as ours at this moment.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I go back and forth, and I have my good days and my bad days, you know, about how to be engaged and how to keep struggling for whatever is left of a good option for our healthcare plan.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it is a compelling moment, and for me, on a personal level, he's been a part of that process.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, were you surprised by Geraldine Ferraro's actions during some of the campaign, some of her statements that he wouldn't have been able to run if he was a woman on such thin credentials? I mean, it almost seems like she went out of her way to bring racism and so on into the campaign, and it reflected on Hillary's.
Yes, it was.
Campaign.
I actually think that both her campaign and Ferraro, and there were multiple moments when the racism was so palpable that it was terribly upsetting. But at the same time, it was also, I thought, a moment of clarity that was important, you know, as an exposure of a politics and a positioning that is not acceptable any longer, to be spoken or to be acted on. And I think we still have to see how that plays out as well, because racial politics is, you know, a tinderbox at the moment, and very much more so because we have a black president.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Zila Eisenstein. She's a professor of politics at Ithaca College, and we're discussing her new book, The Audacity of Races and Genders, A Personal and Global Story of the Obama Election. Now, you made an interesting observation that Hillary remained mute on the issues of patriarchy and sexual discrimination while bemoaning her treatment by the media as misogynist. I found that a very interesting observation. Can we carry that further because she brought it up, or was that just a passing moment?
No, but I think that our society feels very comfortable with that language, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, mm-hmm. because it's like the media is hanging out there, you know. Media is a form of mediating structures of power, and so it's really the next step, which is what really do those images, how do they help to sustain incredible levels of exploitation and oppression of women of all colors, and actually a majority of men at the moment as well.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, so what I thought was not surprising at all is that she felt comfortable to say that the media had been unfair to her, while really not in any way using a serious critique of the sexual hierarchy of this society, the sexual division of labor, the unpaid domestic labor, unfair wages, no daycare system in this country. I mean, you don't have to be a radical to, you know, to just be able to say quite a bit here. And the silences are unbelievably noisy to me.
Yeah. I think a lot of people were surprised that she didn't try to seize her moment to talk about these issues the way Barack did about racism during that incredible interlude when he brought that up after the Reverend Wright, you know,
Well, at that point, she hadn't taken on her feminist posture. And the only time that she really did start to speak in any way that you could say is a structural analysis of women's lives in this country was in her, conceded her concession speech.
Yeah, her concession speech.
Yeah, and that actually had a few radical points in it, and I thought, oh my goodness, the woman has been radicalized. But at that point too, I shifted a little about, well, you know, if I say people can change, you know, people change. Now at the moment, you know, given her positioning, it is interesting that, you know, she has not said anything about multiple issues about women's lives that to me really bespeak an embrace of a radical critique of what is happening, although she now is authoring this idea that the United States, our foreign policy, must have women as a central portion of it. But she takes really the World Bank position on that, mm-hmm. which is that foreign policy will have to make sure that women's lives go forward in other countries, because if their lives go forward, the country's life goes forward, mm-hmm. you know, which...
Something we feminists have been talking about for 40 years.
Yeah, but it also is, you know, why don't we invest in women, because all human beings, you know, have this potential for enormous development. I actually don't think that it is very freeing to say, because women take care of their families and therefore take care of their nations, mm-hmm. that's why uh-huh. the investment should be made in them. Uh-huh. You know, that's uh-huh. still it is what I would call a misogynist framework for mm-hmm. talking about the unbelievable capacity that women have as unique human beings.
Just as human beings. Yeah,
yeah. Just as human beings.
Yeah. Now, you said that Sarah Palin was a well-tuned weapon waiting to be activated.
Oh, yeah.
I love that.
Well, she was. I mean, this idea, I just love it. You know, like people come out of nowhere. I mean, Obama didn't come out of nowhere. He was really honed right in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So Sarah Palin, she was waiting in the wings in essence, and she was chosen by, you know, a series of really, there were about, you know, three of these key neoconservatives that really positioned her very well. And, this idea that, that she was some kind of maverick or...
That was an unbelievable term.
Yeah, it is.
Absolutely unbelievable term in regard to her.
I know. What I loved about her being chosen, in some sense, in the end, politically here, is that it really was interesting. I mean, the choice was, I think, so stupid, this idea that, you know, one vagina is as good as another, you know, so, put her up against, you know,
When Hillary lost, yeah.
Right. And, actually, people said no. So, I mean, there was, you know, for me, on an intellectual level, I'm thinking, okay, so, you know, sex and gender are not the same thing here. And, maybe a more progressive politics can come out of some of these horrific mistakes.
I was going to say ridiculous moves by some of these people.
Yeah, well, Sarah Palin has very serious politics, and they really are ugly.
Oh, indeed.
You know?
Indeed,
and
she
so,
does. That's a good way of putting it, serious politics.
She has very serious politics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think the fact that Hillary almost made it to the presidency, as they say, Sarah Palin was nominated for the first time by the Republicans, has this done anything for women in politics? In regard to, you know, the next steps, or are we still back, you know, waiting for a real progressive woman to run?
Well, you've kind of changed the question for me. The idea is it would be interesting if ever a really radically progressive woman could really be positioned in such a way mm-hmm. as to run for an important national position.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think that Hillary and Sarah Palin being in these political campaigns means that it'll be easier and it gets more normalized that females should be able to be part of the political structure? Sure. Do I think that's a significant thing? Yes and no.
Mm.
You know, I really care that people have a certain politics. I did think that Barack Obama was more of a progressive than Hillary Clinton. So although my life has been dedicated to anti-racist feminism, I mean, I was just caught there, you know, and actually it was a pretty easy decision for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying here is that again, this idea that female and male bodies are the same thing as their politics. No, I don't think that they are. Do I think that female bodies often will mean that if you have a progressive politics, your female body will, in a sense, matter in that politics? Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. But you have Sarah Palin. She has a female body. She has a great female body. You know, she has a Title IX female body. And poor Hillary grew up afterwards, so she's not a triathlete.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh.
So.
And in the same way intellectually as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
Now, do you think we'll see a global impact? Have we already by the Obama election? Did you feel hopeful that it really will or has changed or begun to change the world?
Well, yes. I mean, I think everyone thinks that to a degree. I mean, in terms of the way people talk about it, and particularly people in positions of power across the globe. I also do think, though, that because the expectations are so high, because of the difference from the Bush-Cheney years, that if Obama makes a mess with these just in these next weeks with Afghanistan,
and Afghanistan.
The fall will be really deep.
Really, really. And what are the implications of really deep?
I think that there's a lot of investment right now and hope still. Maybe there's more hope outside the country in certain areas. I think that there's less hope within Palestinian communities right now than there was initially. But I do think that in particularly Pakistan, Syria, in places that are heavily impacted by the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, I think that you have countries that are deeply hoping, because things are as difficult as they are in their home countries, that Obama is going to make a difference and make a foreign policy that is not as exclusively in the interests of the United States. And empire making at this moment, given global capitalism, I think that there is a way that it's not necessarily progressive, but that it's just smart politics for the United States to be a part of the global community, you know, rather than to do this kind of unipolar orchestration.
So. Absolutely, absolutely. Well, we only have a couple minutes left. What do you hope your book will do? I mean, why did you write it? Are you trying to impact a certain group of people or...
Well, you know, everyone has the fantasy that their book is going to, you know, just have this wild impact. of course, early on in my life, you know, I was just absolutely sure I would change the world. And, you know, I've come to be a little wiser. What I really do hope is, first of all, that just some of the complexity of the feminisms across the globe and the importance of the politics that has really grown out of struggles of women, and particularly even in relationship to this particular campaign, that we all will be so much smarter and more humane if we embrace it and know more about it and then try to know our own selves politically better from having a dialogue with me in this book. The book is written with total and, well, as much honesty as I could muster. And the honesty...
It's really like a dialogue or a conversation.
Well, and it does what I really am. I'm showing you my own kind of intellectual doubts and political frustrations, and really trying to say that that is what it means to be a political human being in a world that is enormously complex, and that we just don't have the right, particularly those of us who live in the empire, that we do not have the right to live without knowing what we are doing and what we think about it. And I don't really tell people what to think in the book, but I work really hard at showing you how I try to think and
pass it on.
Pass it on.
You end on a positive note. You say, even though change hasn't happened yet, it has begun. And I thank you for writing it.
Oh, thanks so much.
It's a fascinating book.
I so appreciate the dialogue with you today. Thank you.
The book is called The Audacity of Races and Genders, A Personal and Global Story of the Obama Election. Zila Eisenstein, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.